Hey Blenders, on this week's show, Glass Onion performs very well. We review Andor and add it to our Star Wars tier list. And the Daniels join the show to talk everything everywhere all at once.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Blenders, and welcome to episode number 239 of Real Blend, a podcast that told the Oscars, hey guys, you know what, you should really show all 23 Oscar categories live on the show. And then they were like, you know what, you guys are right, we're gonna go back to doing that. So you're welcome, everybody. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, joined as always, way before that, hold on, Glass Onion performs really well this week. We review Andor and add it to the Star Wars tier list. And we got a fun one for you today. The Daniels, co-directors of Everything Everywhere All at Once, join us. And they implore you, please don't go looking for those rocks. Just don't do it. It's not encouraged by them in the least bit. You guys will understand that when we get closer to the interview. By we, of course, I mean Kevin McCarthy, Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hey, Kev, how are you today?
I'm just really excited that we have two potential Oscar nominees on our show this week talking about farts in a bottle. I just want to put that out there. This is a very serious discussion that we have about Everything Everywhere All at Once. And if you're tuning in now and you like farts and you like bottles, stay tuned.
You're going to hear the word butt plugs a few times in that interview.
Yes, I mean, to be fair, that's Real Blend. And now we're demonetized within the first couple minutes.
What? In context, that's a fair use of the word.
That is a joke from the movie. That completely makes sense.
And the interview. Yeah. Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago, who rethinks joining us every single week.
You have Jakey. Whenever the Academy came to us and asked for our opinion on all the categories, they said, look, they said the only way we're going to listen to you is if you have a member who predicted all the categories earlier this year. Yeah. And you said, hot damn, do we?
What was interesting is Spielberg wouldn't agree to an interview, which is fine. He's busy and he can do whatever he wants. But he did ask us to sit down with him for like 3 hours to talk about how the telecast should work.
Right.
Yeah. And so we did have that conversation with Spielberg.
This is true. We just didn't record it.
Yeah. He was like, I'm thinking about switching to digital. And we were like, do we have some thoughts?
Whoa. And we were all at Amblin and we were riding bikes together. It was just really.
But it was Gabe in the basket.
Oh, I thought you were going to be in my basket. That's what I pictured.
Steven Spielberg said the word digital, I think all the teeth would fall out of his mouth.
Oh, stop.
I just don't think he could process that.
The beauty of it is that he
had it process it.
He never will shoot digital. We're all good.
He can do whatever he wants.
Not yet. If you're watching us on YouTube, hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. We see the subscriptions going up. We're at 10.1 now, which is fantastic, adding them at a Fast and Furious clip. Love the people who come on Friday mornings and start to watch when the notification crew goes off. So thank you for joining us. If you want to join that crew, go to youtube.com/realblendpodcast. Give a like and a subscribe. You guys be part of that community, growing community. Yes.
I have a question for the notification crew, for folks that watch on YouTube in general. Do you enjoy when we set them as a premiere on YouTube? If you're a user of YouTube, you know what that means.
Oh, I don't like that. Nothing matters.
You don't like that? Oh, okay. Well, yeah, it doesn't matter because you don't.
Well, okay. But okay, explain this to me, because whenever I've seen anything on Premiere,
yeah,
and I click on it, it like skips to, let's say, 20 minutes in. And when I try to go back, it doesn't let me go. Like, I don't want to start it at 20 minutes in.
So this is why I'm asking the audience, what do they prefer? So the benefit of the Premiere is that you get to know ahead of time what the episode's going to be and when it's dropping, which is always Friday at 6:30 Central or whatever. But it creates a live watch along experience. Yeah. So it's kind of, it's a little too early for probably most people to be watching along. Some of our international listeners, I'm sure, have a better time with that. But let me know what you, if you like it or if you don't. That's why it has you skip ahead, though, Jake, so that you can be in chat together. And right. But let me know. Drop your thoughts in the comments. Premieres? No premieres?
Have you signed up for Real Blend Premium? you get more useless conversations like this. They go in circles.
But you can pay for them this time. Oh, my God, last week's. Oh, my God.
So as a casual listener, Jake Hamilton, who was not part of that conversation, I would love to hear your comments about the discussion. Not the discussion at play. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the topic.
And we can't restart the discussion.
Good God, would I ever not want you to? In a matter of, I don't know, what was it, 40 minutes? I went through the emotional roller coaster of agreeing with all of you, disagreeing with all of you, hating all of you, and at some point within the 4 minutes, wishing all three of you would just shut up. So it was a pretty good episode. That's a pretty good episode.
It's essentially the show.
That's usually Jake's emotion as he's on the show.
How about we throw it to our interview with the Daniels?
Much better idea.
Film out right now called Everything Everywhere All at Once. And to timestamp it briefly, and I think Jake will mention this in the interview, we got to speak to them the night after the film did very well at the Gotham Film Awards, including a well-deserved pickup for Ke Huy Quan, who I really hope ends up in the Oscar conversation. But
I think he's going to. I think he's going to win. Yeah,
it's very possible.
Oh, he's like on that path. I feel like the supporting category generally the one that pans out to be the one that is the consistent winner throughout the season and generally doesn't change. Yeah. Like the biggest shocks that we've seen are like the actor winning all season and then all of a sudden they switch it Oscar night. But like that supporting category Jake, you know, Oscar's
and he has just as
I
much
do.
Of a narrative as Brendan Fraser does.
Right.
Like, and you know, if Oscar voters love a good narrative to attach to a win, I mean, what a narrative he has.
And obviously, people tuning in, we started off as an awards show and we're going to dive into our awards discussion, obviously, as we get closer to award season. But I will say, as of today, November 30th, going up with the day we're recording the show, obviously going up to this date, I was like, oh, Brendan Fraser's locked in to win, and we've seen it, and it's a phenomenal performance. But as the past couple days have panned by, Austin Butler seems to be getting right up there.
I still think it's Fraser's delivery. The whale hasn't had its moment yet. They haven't sent out screeners. It's too early.
Just saying, I'm feeling that.
I think eight people on Twitter talking about Elvis has all of a sudden shifted the narrative, and that's not the case.
The whale will have a big splash when it finally does.
Ah, well done.
Thank you very much. All right. Okay. Anyway, here's the Daniels talking Everything Everywhere All at Once on the Real Blend Podcast.
Beautiful. I'm going to kick you guys off. Seriously, thank you so much for joining the Real Blend Podcast. We're so excited to have you guys on. We are very much, we our sort of thing that we say is that we're a filmmakers podcast. So please feel free to get into like the nerdy nitty gritty that we oftentimes don't have time for into television slots. So this is your time to do it. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. Absolutely. Well, we want to start by saying congratulations because you guys won Best Feature at the Gotham Awards last night and a very deserving supporting performance award, which we're all very excited about. So I guess just to put a timestamp on this, as we say, like, how are you guys feeling? And I guess just what's the difference between what you expected the reaction to this movie to be and how it was going to perform versus what it ended up doing?
I feel bad for the losers because their movies were so good. It was confusing. It was very exciting to be in sitting at tables next to all the people that made all these good movies, and I did a bad job of saying hello or complimenting them to their faces.
Yeah, I will say that like we were not expecting last night at all. I know people have been saying, oh, it's an awards contender, it's in the conversation, and like internally, we've been laughing at it. Honestly, we're like, I can't believe that people are, you know, like, I know people love our film and they're connecting with it, but it does not seem like the kind of thing we if we were trying to make an awards contender, we would have written a very different movie. You know,
there were certain jokes that stayed in the script.
Less hot dog fingers.
Exactly. So like to us, like we were like, this is very fun. I love talking about this movie. I love talking about our cast and crew. So this campaign has been really actually, you know, it hasn't been quite as soul sucking because we're not really interested in you know, positioning ourselves in that way. We just want to talk about the movie and have more excuses to have screenings. And last night was the first time where it felt very real, and it was actually kind of sobering. I'm still in shock. I'm very excited and very happy for, you know, for our whole team, because it's the whole film got the award, and so it's been really fun just connecting with our cast and crew over text and just feeling really proud of what we did. And so that's been exciting. But now I think I'm having to shift my brain a little bit after last night, because last night I was this has been an incredible year for movies. Honestly, I've there's so many films I've seen that I just absolutely loved, and to be part of the conversation in this year is has been incredible.
Daniel, what is a joke that you're surprised is still in the movie and it's still an awards contender? I heard you mention that.
It's
all the butt plugs.
Isn't it obvious?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, that's like Oscar tonight. You don't
can that be the Oscar clip? The butt plugs?
Yes,
that would be perfect.
Yes, please.
We're going to suggest it. I don't know if our team's going to go for it.
Please. Yeah. It has to be. No, in all honesty.
Posters, yeah, with the trophy on them, yeah.
In all honesty, what I wanted to do is bring you guys now back to the very beginning. I was lucky enough to be sitting in that audience at South by Southwest.
Yes.
And my jaw was just on the floor. It was just on the floor because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And so I can't believe that, like, how confident were you guys going into that screening in particular? Because, you know, up to that point, I don't know how often you'd showed it to a crowd and to really know how it was going to play. And how did you feel kind of immediately after that screening?
That's a great question.
I felt pretty confident.
He's the confident one of the group.
But we've been to South By many times, and it's like a rowdy, fun, film-loving festival. And so
Paramount is great.
I always say it's my favorite festival that we've been to.
So when we got in, I was like, our movie is like, I feel self-conscious sometimes calling our movie an indie film because we got to play with so many more toys than we've ever played with. We got to do full-on action scenes. We got to like work with movie stars. It felt like my version of a big budget blockbuster. And then I was like, oh, we're getting to go to South By. And I knew that Michelle Yeoh does a very good job fighting among other things in our movie. So I don't know, like that screening in particular, I was like, oh, this is gonna be so fun, you know. Yeah. Like, I don't know about the life of the film. Like, my expectations were way lower there, but like, as a person who's been to that festival and had a lot of fun at like crazy screenings of things like Upstream Color or Spring Breakers. Like, yeah. These people are gonna be friendly. Like, this is gonna be fun.
I will say that like after our first experience with Swiss Army Man at Sundance, like we were ready for anything. Like, it's not like we were ready for people to, you know, to really not connect to some of it, which is fine. That's how most of our work has been. But
we were ready for some critical backlash.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And so honestly, the moment the film finished and we were walking backstage, I felt something I'd never felt before, which is like this deep contentment, this deep fulfillment. Because we were backstage and Jamie Lee Curtis had never seen the movie before. And she looked at me and she was bawling and she was just tears on her face. And she said, okay, I finally understand the movie, which was like incredible. Just to have someone like her be the first person I talked to after this movie, you know, a veteran who's done this so many times and seen this process so many times, to see her shook was like incredible. And then right off the bat, the first question we got at the Q&A, if you remember, was a question about intergenerational trauma. And it it wasn't directed to Michelle Yeoh or Jamie Lee Curtis or any of the actors. It was directed to us. And we were like, oh, this film, we thought this was going to be a really fun action movie that would surprise you with heart. And then that night we realized, oh no, the heart is what is going to bring people to the theater. The heart is what's going to have people talking about this movie for a while. And I've mentioned this in other interviews, but like that night I didn't look at my phone once, which is, it's just a sign of how happy I was for just like one night, you know, all these years of filmmaking just for one night of contentment, just not having to look at the phone and distract myself from my awful existence. Just kidding.
You know, I'm going to geek out here because as Jake mentioned, this is a filmmaking show. And I think one of the most extraordinary aspects about the film on a subconscious level is the way you shift the aspect ratio. And I think like as an audience member, when you watch it for the first time, you probably don't even realize what's going on because it's happening so quickly in your mind. But as you go back and watch it multiple times, you start to understand the brilliance of the editing and kind of the reasons for the shifts in aspect ratio. And I was wondering if you could just walk through some of those shifts and kind of like narratively what you wanted to intend and how you lensed maybe each part of the universe. Or I'm just curious, like kind of how that worked and like the choices for the aspect ratios and kind of, you know, again, I think at the end of the day, you want people to not notice it, but also it is a subconscious way for us to know where we are in the exactly. world. So yeah, I'm just curious if you can speak on that. Yeah.
I mean, it's a great specific way to talk about genre in our film, right? The so much of the lensing, the aspect ratio, even the grain structure that we were using was very much inspired by specific genres and familiar just visual tropes that we were playing with, because we wanted the audience to be able to know where they were at any given time without us having to say, the hot dog universe, you know, like we didn't want to have to do that every single time. And so with the base universe, just the regular universe, that was just a simple 1:85 aspect ratio spherical lens. We wanted it to feel very mundane, but cluttered and chaotic. And one of the first time a big aspect ratio shift happens is when Wayman's is about to do the fanny pack fight and his head goes up. And as his head comes down, we watch the thing slowly shift into anamorphic and 2:39 aspect ratio. And so from then on, we established, okay, anytime we're in this universe now, the action universe, it's going to be 2:39. We're in this very cinematic space. But when we cut back to the laundromat party, we're back at 1:85 mundanity or whatever. And so
those became the two big ones.
Yeah,
and right. then we started sneaking a few more in there, like 4:3 for flashbacks to make you think about the past, and going to like 2:1 for the hot dog, which is kind of like Netflix's aspect ratio, because we were just like, it's kind of like a Netflix vibe is what we decided. But it was just also just, it wasn't a ratio we used yet.
Right. I love the 2:1 because it's very much built for the algorithm of the compression algorithm, right? 2:1 is such an easier thing for the compression algorithm to calculate. And so anyway, I love nerding out about that kind of stuff.
And we actually did, you know, we always knew we wanted to do aspect ratio shifts, and our cinematographer pushed back. He was like, guys, that's going to be like obnoxious. Like, But we sold him on it, and then he actually switched lenses almost all the time.
Every universe had a different.
So shout out to the assistant camera team, John Deese and Matt Sanderson, who had to like constantly like, you know, like it's more than just switching the lens. You have to switch the plate, the lens mounts and stuff. And it's like midway through a scene, we would switch back and forth between spherical and anamorphic, like many times, and they had like several lens kits around. Like their job was, it's like they were shooting four movies, you know.
But I will say that the reason why we believed it was going to work and why audiences would be okay with it is that we were watching, I love supercut montages of like cinematic moments in film or whatever on YouTube. So they'll be like, here's 100 different shots of someone kissing, or here's 100 different shots of two people holding hands from films. And like, what's so lovely about those these montages is that you feel a continuity just through the action or the idea or the emotion. And it doesn't matter that it's a completely different aspect ratio, completely different compression. Some are obviously like 16 mil, 35, super 30, whatever. It's like everything all at once. And this film was very much meant to reflect affect the way that we consume media now, which is very much through YouTube or through, yeah, scrolling on Instagram, scrolling on Twitter. And it's about the amalgamation of things. Could we find a way to turn that into a film language?
Mm-hmm. And it was nice to see it in the streaming, by the way, because I'm a physical media fan and I have to buy the Blu-rays in order to get Christopher Nolan's IMAX shifts for like Dunkirk and Interstellar and stuff like that. And then a lot of these filmmakers, they'll go to Blu-ray and like Dune, for example, Greg Fraser, they didn't even get the 143, the 178 at home, I guess. And I'm glad that you guys kept it on the digital release. I'm imagining that was like a talk you guys had to have, right, to keep that digital.
It was, I mean, that was something that we kept like early on. We were like, oh, what are we going to do about the theatrical versus the home? What's the simplest elegant solution? Because I don't want to have to like rethink every single time we're releasing on different medium.
For a little while, we thought about like doing a version theatrically that would be where the whole movie would be delivered on the DCP as anamorphic. And in that version, when he jumps, there'd be black bars on the side that shrink as opposed to black bars in the top and bottom that appear, you know? So it'd be going from like here to here, but we'd have to go through and literally redo a bunch of visual effects and things. We also wanted to do a version where the Rock universe would be the only fully IMAX universe. And we're like, we kind of wanted to go out into the desert with IMAX cameras and be like, just shoot the shit out of those rocks and then do a special DCP export, you know, where it's like nothing in the film, but then like, holy shit, you're in the Rock universe. But each of those ideas would have cost, you know, tens of thousands of indulgent dollars.
And so, yeah, honestly, we went with the easiest solution, which was like, we just, what we saw, what we sent to the DCP as a DCP was exactly what we sent for the Blu-ray.
Wow. Same thing.
Guys, you were kind enough when you were here in Chicago to sign a pair of hot dog hands for me, which I have here in my apartment. And I've got, the boys know, I've got a lot of movie memorabilia in my apartment. I have more people coming over and asking me about the hot dog. Like, dude, like, where did you get those? Like, how do I get? So please, I beg of you, tell me that you guys are on a shelf in your home. You have the butt plugs, or you have the rocks, or you have the hot dog hands without context at all, that they're just there on a shelf.
No,
I have a butt plug. One of our Tim Mulek, our stunt coordinator, actually during the production asked our prop master Josh to recreate one, just build an extra one with our names on it. So it was a really sweet wrap gift. So it says director of the year, Daniel Kwan, director of the year. You know, so that's a really nice little memento from the film. And unfortunately, the rocks are at the bottom of a cliff.
We threw him off a cliff.
Yeah.
What? Really? Why?
It's on camera.
Yeah, you saw it. You saw it happen in the film.
Oh, that's right. And then you didn't actually go grab them when you were like, after you threw them off.
There's like an A24 intern down at the bottom with their hands in the air.
You guys have no idea how terrifying.
For film fans out there, don't go get them. It's dangerous. It's like that's a dangerous desert. It's not worth it. They're just rocks.
It's not that dangerous though. Like if you really want,
it's a literal cliff. It's not worth it. I don't want to be like the Kimiko the Treasure Hunter.
Interesting
spinoff where some fan.
I'm thinking about going now. Where was this?
No, I'm not gonna tell you. I'll tell you where we bought the rocks. In Altadena, California, there's a rock store. They just sell
landscaping
rocks. It's a landscaping place right off the freeway. They cost like $3.
Right.
Are they aware that they sold like next to the Raiders boulder, like two of the most famous rocks in movie history?
No, but I have BTS footage of us picking out the rocks.
I love that you compare it to the boulder from Indiana Jones. That's amazing.
I don't have memorabilia around my house. I feel like sometimes I'll have something sitting around that reminds me too much that I'm a filmmaker, and it kind of makes me feel crazy. Like, I try to make my home make me feel like a normal boy.
at least use the farts from Swiss Army Man as a ringtone for something on your phone or something like that, you know?
We have an office that we share that's filled with like memorabilia and stuff.
Actually have a friend who, after watching our movie, after watching Swiss Army Man, they farted into a bottle and then they taped their ticket stub to the bottle and they gave it to us.
So we have their farts.
Yeah, so it's in a jar. Yeah, you joke.
Dustin,
your friends in all this group would get along very well.
Why are we best friends? This is exactly the stuff that I talk about with my friends all the time.
Oh, no.
Kevin has a bit at Junkets where he shows ticket stubs from old movies to stars. So he actually has a full collection. So, Kevin, now you have to start putting them on the sides of bottles.
Start farting in them.
Before you give them to the celebrities.
Next time I see George Clooney, I'm like, hey, I just farted in this Ocean's 11 ticket stub. What do you think?
Specifically for George Clooney. This is so exciting.
It's a way to escalate the bit. We've escalated the bit. This is going to be a weird question, but I'm thrilled that I have this. And I got it the day it came out because I just wanted to be able to stop on scenes and admire your set design and your production design, which are loaded with details. But I think that is there a danger in getting lost in the specifics and the details and filling those in? Like, what is a set ever done for you guys, or could you constantly be fiddling with stuff?
I think we try to be directors that empower the crew to like do the details and tell them what matters narratively. For the most part, you know, and then there's certain sets that we get really in the weeds on, but like we told our whole crew, like to help them not have panic attacks when we were prepping it, we would say this movie's about quantity, not quality. Like we will not be mad at you for bringing some shitty stuff to set because we're going for quantity here. But there were certain sets, like we said, the apartment that they live in was super important. And we pulled a lot of references from Dan's childhood, our producer's childhood, like to try to get like details of this immigrant home right and make it feel lived in. And so Kelsey, our set decorator, that was the number one priority set, you know, was that opening sequence set, you know, their apartment. But then a lot of the other ones we were like, it can be crappy. Like what's cheap? Like some universes we would just point the camera in a corner, you know, and be like, yeah, well, Michelle, Scream, you're in a universe, you know?
What often ends up happening was like, I say there's like a 20-80% rule, right? 20% really matter, 80% doesn't matter at all. Just give us whatever we can and we'll rewrite to whatever you find us. Okay. But often what happens is something that our set decorator, I'll use Kelsey as an example, something that she thinks is really important, we'll put into the 80% bucket and she'll be like, no, I'm going to rescue this. I'm going to put it up into the 20%. And so, one of the things that she really cared about was the hot dog universe apartment. We're like, don't worry, make it bare bones. It's a joke universe that eventually, obviously you care about, but like, we do not want you to spend too much time on it. Mm-hmm. But she was like, so in love with the idea of making it this soft, gentle, weird place where everything is colored flesh hot dog flesh colors or brown or ketchup colors, or like she has a very specific image and she's like, I'm gonna spend a lot of time on this one, I'm sorry, even though you guys told me not to do this. And every department did this. Every department took something out of the 80% don't worry about it pile and put it into the 20% pile. And so we ended up making a movie that looks like, you know, a bigger
event.
Looks
like we cared about everything,
exactly,
but really they cared about it, you know.
Process. Oh my god, that process is incredible.
So it looks like a 110% movie, you know, it's rather than a 20-80, it's like 30-80, which does, it's impossible. It doesn't make any sense. So that's why when people watch the movie, they're like, how did you do this? Well, it's a lot of trust and it's a lot of allowing people to chase passion. Raccoonie is another good example. We told Jason Hamer, our practical effects guy, one of our practical effects guys, to be like, give us a shitty puppet, whatever you can afford. Like, we do not have money for this.
Yeah, we're like, the joke's funny, even if Raccoonie looks bad.
Yeah, right.
But he got very excited about making a full-blown animatronic that had multiple controls for like twist, rotation, tilt, ears, eyes.
Tail.
Like,
it has a humping action as well, which we didn't use enough of.
Yeah. And so like, yeah, he came to set and we're like, holy cow, this is way better than we expected, you know? But he knew what mattered to us and he prioritized those gags. Like the hot dog hands had to look good and the Raccoonie did not have to look good, but he chose to make that look great. I was just thinking incredible. There was one shoot day that was kind of like the quantity day, And it was very stressful for Larkin, our cinematographer, who likes for it to look good. But he knew, like, this is the day where we're just going to try to get a bunch of multiverses to kind of prove the point. And I think we started in a bar where Jobu shows up watching the TV. Then Michelle went and was a sign spinner. Then she went on to a bus. Then we went into this rental, this space filled with a bunch of janky standing sets that I think is gone now. But we had rented this place, which is like the shittiest sets in Hollywood are all in this one warehouse. And we ran through.
It's not even a soundstage. So like there is like audio is
audio's like, bad. Yeah,
exactly. It's like really
it's like a closet.
Yeah. But we walked through there and all in the same day shot them in the jail, them in the hospital, the baby being born, the martial arts competition, the gymnastics flashback thing.
Oh, we actually cut that.
Then there was like, there were two different gymnastics things we cut. We had a whole list of inserts we were grabbing that day. Michelle had to do like 12 costume changes.
Is why you guys are in awards consideration.
This is why I keep thinking about that video of Chris Nolan writing the memento thing on the chalkboard. I don't know if you guys that kind of reminds me of like all the insanity you guys were doing with this, like keeping everything in order. I want to geek out with you guys because one of the things I really appreciate about the film and is the practicality of what we're seeing. Everything feels like it's in camera. And, you know, we talked about the aspect ratio changes, but I want to nerd out about that fight sequence that you're referring to, the fanny packs fight sequence, which is just obviously a phenomenal fight scene. And it's honestly just one of the most incredibly choreographed sequences I've seen in cinema, just because it's so... It's like it's perfect. Like every bit of it, the hits, the sound design, just the performance of it. It also at the same time, for as ridiculous as something like that would be, it actually works perfectly in the moment. So I was wondering if you could just break down a little bit of the filmmaking behind that, like maybe some of the ideas of how you shot it, how you achieved what you did in camera. I remember geeking out about that couch when they would sink in and how that was practical. I mean, there's so many cool things, but can you talk about the fanny pack fight a bit and just in terms of production?
For sure. Yeah.
We were obsessed with, you know, the old school Hong Kong action movies growing up. This was the moment where we're like, okay, we're announcing ourselves as the film is announcing itself as an action movie. And we wanted to make sure it felt like we were committing. So even like halfway through when you think the fight's over and then he fills the thing with rocks, things like that are like everything that Jackie Chan and Jet Li, they would always do these kind of moments where you're like, okay, the fight's not over, let's keep going, and just building that tension. So we wanted to create a film that a sequence that felt like that, felt as epic and fun and patient as some of that stuff could be. But the tough thing was we didn't have many days to do any of this stuff. Like Ki Hui Kwan, who actually performed a lot of that sequence, he used to be a stunt. He was on the stunt team for X-Men, Bryan Singer's X-Men, which is bizarre.
He's a trained martial artist.
He has a black belt in Taekwondo.
Yeah.
But he was like, when he found out we only had one day to shoot the whole fanny pack sequence, he was like, we can't do this. This would normally take 2 weeks on a normal movie. You guys are going to try to do it in one day. And we were kind of like, yep, we're going to see what we can do. And, because we've been working together for so long. We've all come up through music videos, and music videos, you have no time and you have to shoot a lot. And it all has to be like big, impressive, practical stuff. Music videos are so short that they can't be boring. There's no time for you to fill out the runtime with just like normal shots. Everything has to be magical and interesting. And so we have confidence in our crew, but I think a lot of it had to come. Like, a lot of it came down to the experience of all working together and understanding each other. But then also we had the amazing team, the Marshall Club, which are a bunch of guys on YouTube that we found who basically worshiped those films, studied those films, memorized every fight sequence that Michelle Yeoh's ever been in. Like when they finally met Michelle, they could talk to her through fight scenes, and she'd be like, oh, I know that's Wing Chun, or, oh, okay, great. That's whatever. She like, so having those boys help us shoot a previs, so we knew exactly what we needed, was super helpful.
So they, and yeah, I think part of what made them great is that they're more than just good martial artists with fun fight ideas. They're good filmmakers. Yeah. They, like, and so like they shot these previses based on like our loose outline of the fight. They shot these little short films in a warehouse that were already had good shots. You know, like I think sometimes we would watch really talented fight choreographers previses and be like, I just don't relate with their filmmaking. Like, and that's such a huge gap to be like, I just don't like your, I can't tell if I like this fight because the shots are so the opposite of what I would want. And the, and these guys are so fun and playful. So we had that, we'd been working on that for like a month or two and cutting it down and killing darlings. And so we had it shot for shot.
And like reshooting stuff that we wanted to get a little bit more specific.
But we knew like beat for beat, shot for shot, what the scene's going to be. We saw a lot of the problems that were coming down the pipeline. And so Tim Mulick, the stunt coordinator, rehearsed the hell out of that scene. Every single fighter was also the actor. We didn't, we cast stunt people. Oh. So there were no, like
no doubles,
no doubles, no fear of continuity. It's like, no, that's the guy. That's the guy that's going to do the thing. And then we worked with our cinematographer to make sure the whole environment was pretty much pre-lit. So as we went through 60 different setups in one day, it was lit, and he would tweak and adjust. And we shot list, we scheduled the day based on sunlight because there's the big atrium windows. But otherwise, we made a lot of choices. Right. To be able to just fly and have fun, and for us to shoot it and for the actors to do the action.
Yeah, that's the other thing. We did not want to have a second unit director do it because that's the, this is the reason why we wrote the movies. We wanted to direct some action.
Yeah, everybody said that's how action movies work, is there's a stunt, there's a second unit director who's going to do the fights.
Yeah.
And like, I was like, no, fuck you, I quit. if I don't get to shoot the shots where Michelle Yeoh like punches people, like why did I fucking write this movie? I'm out. Like, kidding?
The last little tidbit I'll say is like we, because honestly we made this because we love action movies, so we're gonna nerd out about it for a little bit. We were lucky enough to be at the Sundance Institute, the Sundance Labs, in like 2014, 2015, and Quentin Tarantino was one of our advisors.
He's this filmmaker.
And have you heard of Quentin Tarantino?
Is that really his name, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a weird name, right? It's he's a European director.
Yeah, he's European.
But he. You know, we were talking about Swiss Army Man, blah, blah, blah. But Kill Bill came up and he started talking about the difference between shooting action in Hong Kong versus action here. And it's obvious now when we look at it, but he's like, filmmakers here often, and this was a while ago, so things have changed, but filmmakers here often treat action scenes like they would a dialogue scene. You shoot the master, you get the close-ups. If you need a couple inserts, you get the inserts. Yun Wu Ping, you know, the great choreographer who's basically done every amazing kung fu movie you've ever seen, including the ones here in the US. The way they do it is they shoot it in order, one shot at a time, figuring out what is the best shot for this moment, for this specific punch, for this fall. Oh, should this be a combo where we hold it in a wide shot? But they're shooting it sequentially to get basically the maximum narrative out of it. And I think that's why you say it's a very satisfying, fun thing that feels like it works, is because every time we have an impact, we have to think, okay, what is the best way to shoot this impact? And it's the whole thing feels so much more alive because of it.
We did not shoot that way.
Yeah, exactly.
I wish we could have, but like we tried to balance between the two.
Reverse engineered it. Yeah.
But so we tried to, like, we definitely didn't do the coverage thing. We definitely did the shot for the action, but still had to shoot it out of order and plan it all in advance more than, they did back then.
And then we managed to pull it off all in one day. We did go overtime that day, which was tough. It was a tough day.
I hate going overtime. So I was like, let's get rid of some shots.
Insane. It's insane. One, you guys did it in a day. That's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
I think it was 2 days to do
the lead up to
everything in front of the elevator. So like one day was all the talking, like, really, you want to divorce this paperwork, punching Deirdre? Oh, I think even the chapstick was on the other day.
Yeah.
And then one day was like, all right,
fight. Yeah.
We're fighting.
Wow. That's incredible. Guys, I really wish we had more time. We love talking to you. We're so happy to have you guys on the show. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your incredibly busy schedule. to be with us. It's honestly, it's the best film I've seen this year. And
thank you.
Just in love with it. So thanks for joining us, guys. We really appreciate it.
This was really fun. You guys are great. This is, okay. I'm excited to see what you guys do with this, but thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, congratulations to you guys. Thanks for making us movies that make us want to go to the film.
Don't look for the rocks. But thank you for your compliment, and don't go looking for those rocks.
All right. Maybe find the rocks.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
We want to thank Daniel and Dan for joining us. Hopefully they become return guests. I say that all the time, but those guys really seem to enjoy geeking out about the small things, the small techniques that come with filmmaking and putting together a movie that, like, I cannot even comprehend how they maintained the continuity of their story. And when Kevin, you start asking about aspect ratios, but aspect ratios shifting in multiple times in the middle of scenes and how frustrating that is for their DP and the people who have to take care of all the tech that goes with the DP. I could listen to them talk about making that one movie legitimately for a month.
I never really thought much about this, but I feel like it's become a topic. You know, we had this, Kevin and I had a moment with Jordan Peele earlier this summer, and I know it's been a thing with Denis Villeneuve and Dune, but like, it's gotta be really frustrating for filmmakers these days to not just worry about the product that's going out in theaters, but now having to worry about not having control over what it's going to look like at home, like that feels like a whole other set of concerns that honestly a filmmaker shouldn't have to worry about. I hearing them talk about what we thought about having to change the entire film because of what it will look like, which is, you know, moving forward after it leaves theater, you know, it's only going to be in theaters for, let's call it, what, 6 months. And then from, you know, in perpetuity, it's at home. So really, you have to be almost more concerned about what it looks like at home than what it looks like in theaters. And that shouldn't be the case. Like, it almost makes me feel bad for these filmmakers that, I mean, that shouldn't be a concern. It should just be, this is the movie we made, and at home, it's going to look the exact same.
And that's the, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because two things. One, in terms of the aspect ratio discussion, one of the things that, as a viewer, when you watch Everything Everywhere All at Once for the first time, general audiences are not going to notice it. You're not supposed to. Like, it's supposed to be a completely subconscious thing that just lets you know where you are in the movie. But as you go back and rewatch it multiple times, the one that they brought up specifically was right when we go into the fanny pack fight, how the screen just goes down into the wide screen. And they were physically moving the frame and the aspect ratio into the scene, which is really cool. But to Jake's point, one of the things that was really frustrating, we saw this with Dune, is that, you know, Dune was filmed with this IMAX ratio for these dream sequences and the sequences in the desert and everything. And then the release just came out in pure widescreen. Nope is another example where if you don't get the physical disc for Nope, you cannot see the IMAX transitions that you saw.
Sean
in theaters.
Prefers Peacock with the commercial breaks.
Well, here's the thing. I think you guys are talking about like the 1%. Like, I think there's a 1% of filmmakers that are like extremely concerned about this. And then for everything else, there's like the Smiles of the world and the Man from Autos of the 100%. World.
I think it's bigger than 1%. I feel like if you think about it this way, think about box office numbers. And you see like numbers for like Dune.
I can't do another box office conversation.
No. This is not a Scorsese thing. This is more of like a, like there was a big IMAX film that came out recently where people were tracking how many people were going to the theaters just to see it in IMAX. Because
was it Avatar Top Gun re-release?
It may have been Top Gun. Top Gun's yes, because Top Gun
just
shot
coming back to theaters.
Right. And they shot in IMAX for the sequences within the flying. And kudos to Top Gun. their digital and their physical release both shift IMAX aspect ratios. Mm. So when you're within the middle of watching Top Gun on iTunes or streaming it, you do get those jumps in those transitions, because at the end of the day, Sean's brought up a point before, and this is not an uncommon point. When Nolan started doing this years ago with Dark Knight, and you know, and just this shift to IMAX, this a gigantic shift, what he was doing with these cameras and the changing of the quality of a 65 millimeter IMAX image to a 35 millimeter IMAX image, Sean said it can be distracting. And I think back then there was no protocol on how to do it, when to do it. It was just doing it for how cool it would look. And then as filmmakers learned, they were like, oh, what if we did it narratively? What if we started messing around with it from a story perspective? And like Jordan Peele told our show, he did it when you weren't expecting it, so it punches you in the face kind of thing. Mm. So it's gotten to a point where filmmakers are taking advantage now of the tool, just like a lighting or a score or any type of other tool they would use to enhance a sequence. It's becoming more and more important. And I think that's kind of what's happening now. And you heard the Daniels talking about it, and their film on streaming gives you all the transitions, which mm-hmm. is really cool.
Gabe, what'd you have to ask?
I was just going to add before we move on, my favorite in recent memory, as far as like aspect ratio shifting trick, and for a narrative reason, is still It Comes at Night. To me, because as that gets more claustrophobic, and as that story goes from being like very, very kind of slow and just suspenseful is a bit of the word, but it's just you're anticipating what's going to happen, and then as that ramps up, he just slowly until the aspect ratio is mm-hmm. very thin.
Makes me nervous just thinking about it.
Well, it's a tool, good. And then last thing I'll say is I know we're about to move on, William. We'll talk about this when we get to The Whale. And hopefully we'll get Aronofsky on the show if it happens. But The Whale is shot completely 4:3. The entire film is about 1:3:3, which is basically the aspect ratio Snyder did Justice League in.
Yeah.
Because you feel like you're in an apartment in a box the whole time. And that's cool. And it works.
All right. So we had a conversation on the premium about the box office. And that's not why we're bringing this up. But this is an interesting talking point with regards to Glass Onion, because that's the story that we're getting to next. And we're discussing
If anyone thought that the premium discussion meant we weren't going to talk box office on this show, you're mistaken.
No, that's crazy.
That's crazy. Of course we're going to talk box office on this show,
because there's still some really interesting aspects for specific movies. And for this one in particular, Glass Onion going to a limited theatrical push Netflix, and doing 13.2 million in only 696 theaters. Now, that goes to show that, like, per theater, it was doing extremely well. You saw reports from different people, audience members who were going to screenings on Twitter, talking about how their screenings were mostly packed. It was tough to get seats, sold out shows in different areas. When we had Ryan on our show, he talked about, you could see the look on his face of like the fear that he had of people not being able to get to a theater to see it, knowing how badly his audience and fan base really wants to go see it in a theater. You heard all the things that we were saying about it, of like how well it plays with an audience. And so, you know, we're paying a lot of attention to what that number means, the 13.2 million and the only 696 theaters, and questioning why doesn't Netflix leave it in theaters longer? There isn't another big movie that's in theaters until probably Avatar, which is December 16th, I want to say. You know, you have Man Called Otto, and is that opening before that? Like, I looked at the December. You're muted, Jakey. I looked at the December release.
That's January. Sorry, I've been coughing.
Oh, is it really January?
Is January. Yeah, I think they're doing the limited January in New York at the end of December, and then wide in January, which honestly, that feels like the perfect January move. Like, let Avatar have a few weeks to itself, and then this sort of, you know, counter programming of, look, Tom Hanks is grumpy comedy comes out.
Yes, Gabe.
I want to mention something anecdotal, which we like to do when we talk about these things. I've had this week several friends reach out and be like, hey, I think I'm going to go see Glass Onion. And I'm like, well,
Are you though?
You can't. And they're like, what? I just heard that, you know, it did really well.
Most people I know don't know that it's a limited release. I honestly think what, today's the last day, the day we're recording, Wednesday, November 30th.
Yesterday.
Well, I think starting today, there are a lot of people who are showing up at the theater or are refreshing their phone over and over again.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because it's unfortunate. I think we wanted it to just be released fully in theaters, but it is unfortunate that they didn't even give it the chance to have some word of mouth screenings, you know, within the next week. Like the fact they only gave it that those few days is
a bummer. I read somewhere, and I could be wrong, and I don't want to quote this to anything, but I read that it may have been strategically done this way in a way where they put it out for a week with the hope that it would create a want for more and that it would go, oh, I missed it. Now I need to watch it on Netflix in 3 weeks. And I think, like, that's the whole thing is like, from the article that I read, there's different schools of thoughts of how Netflix operates. And like, this is the first time I believe that a Netflix film has officially been released in an AMC and Regal theaters.
Yes, that was a groundbreaking deal. Yes.
And that was a big deal. And I think because that's why, like, you know, we joke sometimes about how when we do screenings for Netflix, we can't do them at AMCs and Regals because they don't allow them. But in this case, there was a deal made where they were like, oh, we'll do the 23rd or the 29th of November. It's Thanksgiving. We'll give you 1 week and then we'll stream on the 23rd. Now, generally speaking with Netflix, like with Pinocchio, for example, like we're going to have Guillermo del Toro on the show, you know, that is a release that came out, I think, 2 or 3 weeks prior in theaters, and then it will be in theaters up till December 9th, which is the streaming release, and sometimes even carry over. This is
Emancipation's going to theaters December 2nd, and it'll stay in theaters until, but it's only a week. It's a week.
Right. But now this is a unique case because they put it in theaters and then ripped it, and now we don't have it streaming. So the question, we all were questioning why not extend it. And I think the biggest thing that I understood from the articles I was reading was this was literally the plan was like for us to be like, oh, wait, we can't see it anymore. Why? What happened? Why was it limited? Oh, everyone's talking about it. Wait, I got to wait now 3 weeks. So they hope their main hope is that you watch it on the platform. That's what they want.
Yeah, that's my big.
I think it's backwards thinking, though, in my mind.
Well, it's this week. That's the case, but what is the audience going to feel, you know, but when Avatar happens, you know,
like it's weird.
Zach's just going to fizzle by the time you get there.
Right. Why wouldn't you do it the week before? Like, I guess if I'm marketing, why would you not put it if it streams on the 23rd? I guess you're going against Avatar at that point because Avatar drops the 16th. And then
there's the thing. Don't stream the 23rd. Stream this Friday.
No, that's what I'm saying. What if? So Gabe's point is this: like, okay, we just came out of the 23rd to 29th release, and now we have 24 days until it releases on Netflix. So right now we're talking about it, but next week it's going to be a back of our mind conversation, and then it'll reemerge when the streaming comes out. I think Gabe's point, and I don't want to speak for Gabe, but wouldn't it be smarter to have released it for a week in theaters and then taken it out the day before it streams?
I think it's fair. I think it's fair for if they are going for that strategy, I think it's totally fair to try it out. I mainly say that as of like, well, it could kind of end up not being anything if people not forget about it, but like,
it's different. You're
right. The interest right now today seems to be very high for people because it's not available. And sure, okay, you're creating this
momentum,
this sense of scarcity. But by then, you know, people's minds move on very quickly. To give Knives Out credit, to give that franchise credit, I do think it is a special case where, like, people really enjoyed that first movie. It is really entertaining, and this one is getting such good reviews that maybe for this, that doesn't matter. And I think people are going to be excited to see it wherever they can see it.
So. But they spent $450 million reportedly on two Knives Out films. And, like, and at the end of the day, we all discuss this a lot on the show. How is Netflix actually making money, right? And like, and that, you know, and while they have millions of subscribers, and you could base the number of hours people watched Wednesday, for example, but you know, at the end of the day, how do you define your profit? And I get that becomes from the subscriptions and how much they're making and how much they're putting into films. But if you spend $450 on two Knives Out movies, what did the first one make? $311 million or whatever it was. I read a stat yesterday that this movie could have easily done $300 million worldwide had it been given a proper release structure. Now, if I'm Netflix, I think the second one you're releasing, the next Knives Out, you really need to strategically build a 45-day theatrical experience of that movie, then go to streaming. Because, like, Gabe's brought this up before, Netflix is now a legit studio, just like Paramount, Universal, Warner Brothers, right? So their brand, if they can make a deal with AMC and go, all right, we're now one of those guys, so give us the 45-day window, then we'll go to our platform. It's the same reason people don't go to theaters and they just wait for the home video release anyways. If you're not interested in going to a theater, you'll just wait for it to hit Netflix. So I think there's a lesson to be learned here, because I think, and I think you guys will all agree, they're missing out on millions and millions and millions of box office dollars by taking this out of the theaters. And this was always the plan. This is not a surprise. It's just kind of like, you're kind of like throwing away money.
Jakey, what's your take?
I mean, this sort of reminds me of that really great speech at the end of Moneyball, where the the owner of the Red Sox tells Brad Pitt, like, you're the first one through the door, like, you're going to take all the hits. Like, Netflix, none of the streaming services have ever really done anything like this before, where they want to capitalize on a movie at the box office, but also capitalize on as a streaming service. I think we are moving into a future where Netflix is going to be putting out their major titles in theaters for a couple of months before putting it to Netflix. Yeah. This is just them dipping the toe in the water. Unfortunately, I feel like it's yielded more negative press than anything. Like Kevin said, every headline over the last 72 hours about this movie has been about how much money they left on the table. But this is their first attempt. This is their first attempt. I mean, it was never
this
going to go.
I mean,
this was never, they were never going to go from, we're a streaming service through and through, to here's a movie with a 3-month theatrical exclusivity. You know, they tried the week thing. They realized, holy crap, look how much money we left. We screwed up. We messed up. They're now trying to overcompensate by putting it back in theaters after it's already available to people streaming, which I think is also a mistake. But again, to sort of quote the Moneyball speech, like, this is the first one through the door. It's going to take all the slings and arrows. It's going to take all the hits. But now they can get it right from here on out.
Here's the thing about it, though, and this is where I differ from what you guys are saying. I don't think that this is a mistake for them, because Netflix as a company is 100% a streaming service. So
for now,
everything that they're doing is driving people to go check out things on their streaming service.
They used to be a DVD delivery service.
Hold on. I know. Yeah. I understand. But they create a buzz for a week. And everybody says, well, how come this didn't stay longer in theaters? But they don't want their movies in theaters. They want their movies on their streaming service, the majority of them. So then they send everybody over to the streaming service, because one of the things that they want to do is to be able to pump up numbers of views and amount of things that are watched on their streaming service, because now there is an alternative on Netflix for a paid subscription, you know, where you get advertising. You pay a little bit less, but you get advertising. So now they have to start showing some statistics over there to show that people are turning things on Netflix and keeping them on for a longer period of time so they could sell to advertisers. That's where they're going to make a lot of their money back. Like, it would be nice for them to get a Knives Out every once in a while that maybe does 300 million. But think about all the other movies that Netflix are putting on their streaming service on a regular basis that would never go to a theater.
I was just about to say the same thing. I was about to say, like, Gray Man and Six Underground, these movies that cost 200 million plus, I feel like wouldn't have done that well in theaters with a wide release as something like a Knives Out, because Knives Out was a built-in franchise. It had an interest. I think Six Underground and Gray Man are films that would be designed for theater. They're Michael Bay and the Russo brothers. But those are movies that would not have had, in my opinion, I could be wrong, but I don't think they would have had gigantic box office monumental milestones. I think they would have done fine. Knives Out is just based purely off the curiosity of how much people love the first one. And that's why it works. So it's almost like kind of Sean saying, like, you certain movies will work for this format. But like, even if Netflix got exclusivity to like Mission Impossible, for example, I know it's Paramount. But if they had Mission Impossible 7, of course you want to put
could
that
happen
in theaters,
somewhere down the line. You never know. But I'm then just, today, in an article in a cover story that James Cameron did for The Hollywood Reporter, which I read from start to finish, by the end of that article, James Cameron was saying this, and I think this is really important for us to consider as a show that we are doing. He said during the pandemic, he was on Zooms with Steven Spielberg and Guillermo del Toro, and the three of them were lamenting to themselves, guys, we're out of business. Like, movie theaters are not going to survive this. We're not going to have the ability to do what we do, which is tell stories on a big level. And then Cameron said, Well, all right. I got to rethink this. Isn't necessarily the case. They are telling stories in other medium. I might just have to shift the type of story that I tell. He goes, look at the types of things they're doing with huge budgets on streaming services. Maybe that's where I'll be in a couple of years. That's Jim Cameron saying that, like, I might be heading to a streaming service one day. It's like,
you'll never hear Christopher Nolan say that.
Maybe right not, now. But Nolan is an anomaly. He's without a doubt an anomaly. Him and Spielberg are. Scorsese went.
You could get Nolan if you gave him the money that he needed to tell whatever story that he can't get told anywhere else, and you gave him a 45-day window.
True.
Now that's the true. Yes. Yes.
That's the true.
And that's incentive. That's incentive for Netflix for sure.
Exactly. Give Cameron a 45-day window for Avatar 7, and then put it and then put it on.
You know, how much money they would have to spend to buy Avatar 7 if we ever get it?
He literally said, he goes, I'll be 89 by the time parts 6 and 7 come out.
Wait, Sean,
he's talking realistically.
How far did you get into Terminator 2 today?
I turned it off after the motorcycle truck chase, which was phenomenal. But then
the beginning.
I had work to do. Yeah, I had work to do.
How could you turn
I just put it on the background. It was like background noise. And then I'd look T2 up every once in a while.
Turns it off.
I did today. all right. We're going to get to a review of Andor, which Jake and I got a chance to see all the way through to the end. And then we're going to add it to our Star Wars tier list. I said this at the beginning of the series. First couple episodes, I was like, this is starting to feel like some of the best Star Wars that I've seen since Disney took over Lucasfilm. And that includes, I put it above Force Awakens, and I put it above Rogue One, because it did to me what Rogue One did, which was introduce new characters that we hadn't seen in the world before, but still felt very much like they were part of the Star Wars galaxy. Told a story that was tangentially connected to one of the Star Wars films, in this case leading up into A New Hope, but making you get invested in a whole slew of new characters. And this was after the first three episodes, which we're not going to get into spoilers here. This is a spoiler free conversation, Gabe. Is that right?
Spoiler free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the story goes in a number of different directions following the three episodes that I watched. And by the end of it, I am now 100% convinced that it's the best Star Wars that I have seen outside of, I would say, New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. And it is just, I credit Tony Gilroy. I credit Toby Haynes, who's the director who handled a number of the episodes. There were a few of the directors sprinkled in. They're all dialed into this main story. I credit the cast. Diego Luna has been fantastic as casting Andor. Andy Serkis came in for a three episode arc and knocked it out of the park. It was incredible from start to finish. And when it ended, I legitimately couldn't wait for it to continue. And I haven't felt that way about Star Wars in a really long time, like sitting through Obi-Wan and pushing myself through things like the Book of Boba Fett, you know, which kind of went off the rails. I loved Mandalorian. I really did enjoy Mandalorian, but I think Andor is even on another level, I think, in terms of the storytelling. And it's Tony Gilroy is the perfect guy for this type of storytelling, because he has a good political sense. He really dials into the haves and have nots of the people who are in the rebellion and the people who are in the empire, and the motivations that can spark the people in the rebellion to get involved. Even some of the people who you would never expect to rise up and fight. And there's elements in the finale. There's a speech from a person who's very important to Cassian Andor. That just had me wanting to stand up and run through the wall, you know, for the rebellion. And I haven't felt that way in a really long time. I don't think that the three movies that started with Force Awakens did a whole heck of a lot to make me feel part of the rebellion. They would mention it here and there. They'd cut back to Carrie Fisher, you know, trying to motivate the troops from wherever she was at. But that always felt disconnected from the story that I think they were trying to tell at heart. Andor gets totally into it. I loved it. And I hope Jake liked it as much as I did.
I have a quick question, Sean. In that speech, is that the speech where the guy says they swim now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
I was trying to remember. Okay.
That was you. It. Yes.
I love that speech.
Yeah.
I agree with you. You know, it's funny. I was with something that is this good, I instantly start getting pessimistic because I'm afraid that Disney and Lucasfilm will learn the wrong lessons from why this is so good and why people are responding so well. But I think it says something that there's a moment near the end of Andor where music starts playing at a funeral. Mm. And that moment, not a lot of special effects, not a lot of pomp and circumstance. It's just a simple moment where music plays at a funeral, and it is more effective, more exciting, more dramatic, more powerful than anything we've seen from Star Wars, maybe since Disney bought it. And I just wish that they would look at that and go, the simplicity of this moment. Why does this moment work so well? And we throw all of this money at Book of Boba Fett and Obi-Wan, and it doesn't have a fraction of the emotional impact that this singular, quiet, little cheap moment, not cheap, cheap is the wrong word, but a less expensive moment in Andor had. I mean, it goes back, and I've talked a lot about this, as simple as it sounds, shooting on location, like making me feel like, one, getting your ass off of Tatooine,
yeah,
showing that there are other planets in this vast, wide galaxy of far, you know, far, far away, and making us feel like these worlds are tangible, like we know what they feel like. Like, you know, it's the same problem I'm starting to have with MCU, is the same problem I started having with Star Wars, is that you can look at all of these series lately and you can almost see that screen behind them and them, yeah, standing in front of it and whatever props it is. And this was shot on location. It's shot here and it's shot there. And it also, you know, I've been scoffing at, plus sized seasons lately. Whenever I first heard 12 episodes for Andor, I thought, my God, like what could possibly, but it's also a reminder that, like, one, sometimes these stories need time. Mm-hmm. And also, not every episode needs to have these big, massive action beats. If it's written well enough, and the other ones haven't been, quite frankly, if it's written well enough, the characters and the story are sufficient. You don't need to distract me with special effects and explosions if the stories are... I mean, my favorite moment in all of Star Wars is I Love You and I Know. It has nothing to do with special effects or explosions or anything. Like, what about
like a 50s inspired neon colored biker gang?
Okay, that I'm a little bit more forgiving, because that really did feel like a tip of the cap to George Lucas and an American Graffiti. So I was a little bit more forgiving of that than most people were. But it's just like, I just really hope that, and I don't know what the ratings for Andor have been compared to everything else, but the general reaction has undeniably positive. And I just hope that Disney looks at what's happening with Andor going, like, maybe we should start making stuff like this. And I worry that, just based on my pessimism of how this industry works, I worry that it's going to be the exception and not the rule.
Well, I think Ahsoka, I've heard really good things about Ahsoka because it's Dave Filoni basically shepherding it along, and he loves that character extreme. And I think Rosario is perfect for that part. And to talk about shooting on location, like you mentioned, like, there's a moment where, without spoilers, Cassian has to sort of run away to some place, and he lands at a place that kind of looks like the French Riviera, right? Yeah. But it has stormtroopers all over it. And when we arrived there, it was so jarring to me because I hadn't seen Star Wars in a location that looked so totally different from anything that we'd seen. But yet they were weaving it into a Star Wars movie. I was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. Stay here.
And there are ways of integrating other places we know. There's a very quick one-off line where a character is berating her husband for being a gambler. And she says something along the lines of, like, if you have to, go to Canto Bight. And just that one little line honestly made the Canto Bight sequence in Last Jedi, which I hate so much. I hate that sequence. But even it sort of made me go, like, okay, it added a layer, because it reminded me that, like, these planets are out there. You don't have to keep going back to planets that we've seen 1,000 times before, like reminding us that they exist. But then take us to new places, make us fall in love with these other planets in the same way that you made us fall in love with Hoth. Like, in all honesty, how have we not been back to Hoth?
I know.
Like, we go back to like, not that I know I just berated Star Wars for using the same planets over, but it's just like, it's just amazing that, like, we, like, I like the one planet they love going back to is the most dry, desolate, boring planet in all of the galaxy. But you've got this cool ice planet, and you've got Endor, and you've got,
I will say, you know, if we're given The Last Jedi love, its salt planet is its version of a Hoth planet. So
It is, and visually.
That's visually one of my favorite planets in Star Wars. Yes, yeah. That is. Yeah. But like the image of the ripping up of and the, like the red flying. Like, look, I by no means am I a Last Jedi fan, but even I will admit that that is the most one of the most beautiful, gorgeous visuals.
Well, would you two Star Wars? Would you two gentlemen like to add this to our Star Wars tier list?
I'd love to.
Yeah, I just like the scene when they were trying to figure out his name, and the mom was like. And we could do like and then they figured it out. I thought that was just.
Right. You've been doing yoga, Kevin, because you're stretching, huh?
It's good. Yeah. It's
great. Kevin so badly wants to be a part of this conversation, but he hasn't seen Andor yet.
The mom was like, "And
Kevin, did you start it? Did you get
I've seen episodes 8 and 9, I think.
That hurts my soul a little bit. I know why you had to watch them for the Andy Serkis interview. But that hurts my soul a little bit.
They swim now. No, I'm just excited about that.
It's true. I put the Fablemans in for Michelle, but we started at the 2-hour and 10-minute mark. And just watched it till the end.
That's a great idea.
She was very confused.
Yeah.
But, still laughed at the final shot.
Which of you two want to kick off? Sean, where do you put it?
Yeah, this could be and or an A or.
All right.
It's an S. Right. I think it's an S, and I think it's an unquestionable S.
I love that, Jake.
This is where it's going to get complicated. I think it is a very strong A. I think S, particularly with Star Wars, comes with time and perspective of which we've had neither. Yeah. When it comes to Andor, it's not to say that in 10 years I won't look back and go, oh, yeah, absolutely. In the grand scope of Star Wars and how it has sat with me, I'm not comfortable. Particularly not comfortable rating it above A New Hope and Return of the Jedi, which I know shouldn't be a thing, but it very much is a thing. So for me, it is a very strong, respectable A.
And again, while we're not comparing to where things are on the tier, putting it on the same parallel as Rogue One makes sense to me. That's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's half the story right now.
Sure.
There are still a number of major things that have to happen. So I can backpedal to an A. I'm all right with that.
All right.
Wait, what's our S?
And it's Empire? Not to say, yeah, it's not to say that, like, you know, by the time Andor is done, that that I won't look. Because here's the thing. What's funny is, and I love Mandalorian. I don't really know how Mandalorian's going to wrap up, but I have a feeling like that's probably always at its most going to be an A for me.
Probably. Yeah.
Andor to me has the potential to head into S territory. It's just hard to judge it. And it's in its incompleteness right now.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay.
All right.
It's an A.
It's an A.
There we go.
But Dan, isn't it crazy? Like, think back to what was it? It was March or April when that first Obi-Wan trailer dropped. And I remember, dude, I'm not gonna lie. I'll be the first person to be like, Andor. Like, why? Who cares about Andor? Why do we need a? And I flash forward and. That's Obi-Wan is the series I'm going, why does that exist? And Andor is the one I'm going, oh, thank God, Star Wars is back.
And heading into the release of Obi-Wan, like, I've got a few friends at Lucasfilm, and they were sending messages of, like, for Obi-Wan, like, this is the one. Like, they're really excited.
It was a typo. This is Obi-Wan. This is Obi-Wan. That's what they were trying to say.
They were hyped for that one. They thought the teaming of Hayden and Ewan again was
our tier list, I think we put it at a C.
James Wan?
And I don't remember where I had it. But like Obi-Wan did have great moments.
It's fine.
They were few and far between.
I'm excited to catch up on Andor.
Like this week's premium episode. It mostly just made me angry, and I was happy to turn it off.
Same.
All right, let's go to a quick ad break. We'll see you guys.
It was full of characters I love, but my God, it angered me.
And we are back. Okay, so we mentioned that Glass Onion was not taking advantage of the theaters, but Paramount wisely has decided that there's an opening. Why don't we put Top Gun back in theaters? And it's I think it's serving two sides. It's essentially going to allow people to go see it on the big screen, which is this is a movie made for the big screen and these larger screen formats. But this is an awards season as well, too. And Top Gun is a player. And so I do think coming back to theaters and generating some headlines around the types of, more box office, showing the type of muscle that this movie has. Is going to affect some people who are putting their lists together, of which the three of us are Critics' Choice Association members and our ballots are due soon. And so this is a strategic play on Paramount's part as well, too. Jakey.
I have a quick question for you, because I know you are a fan of nice round numbers. Last I checked, it was at like $1.486 billion, which means it only needs like 15 million or so to hit that 1.5. Does it have another 15 in it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think it does.
See, honestly, but at first I was like, oh, only 15, but like,
a lot 15 of money. I mean, I don't want to go see it again.
15 is a
it's
lot
coming to
of
IMAX.
Money.
It's coming to IMAX as well.
Let me, this is a number I saw today and it really it's surprised possible. Me. Well, this is global. This was globally. When right. Avatar re-released in September, it did another 76
yeah,
million.
Yeah, but it had been
dollars.
Literally it had been literally years since it left
4K.
Theaters.
It was new.
And also you had this new sequel coming out, and so a lot of people felt like, "Oh, I want to go see this one before 2 comes out." Avatar just left theaters, and a lot of people have it on their TVs.
Top Gun.
I'm sorry. Top Gun had just left theaters, and a lot of people just bought it at home. Right. Within the past couple of weeks, I just, you know, as crazy as it sounds, 15 million might be a lot. I actually am leaning more with Kevin in that, I hope it does, because I'd love for it to hit that $1.5 billion mark.
I think that
possible.
I think that you're not wrong, and I won't be surprised if you're correct in that assessment, but you might be underestimating the sort of meme factor of Top Gun. Like, Top Gun was like so big culturally as like the cool thing to go see. Everyone was talking about it. I could see large groups of friends being like, that movie was so kick-ass. And the movie is so exciting in theaters that people would be like, one more chance to go see that again. Let's ride or whatever they say.
That's how they should. Honestly, that's how they should sell it. Like, look, we're about, you know, remember like back in the day when Disney would release, or you know, movies on VHS, and they marketed as buy it before we put it back in the vault. It really made it sound like, oh my God, I gotta get it right now, or I'll never be able to get it. They really should market it in such a way, like see it on the big screen for the last time or something, like really kind of make it a like, look, this, you're not going to get this chance again kind of thing.
That would be very smart. I would
this
go
is
see
the
it
second
for that
re-release they've done.
It is.
Yes, by it the is. Way, this is not the
well,
first
thin,
re-release.
That's how thin the calendar is this year. The release calendar.
I know. Right. I know. You know what else you get re-released is Morbius. What if we get Morbius back in theaters?
We did. Well, for a second.
Speaking of numbers, I read this today. Doesn't the first Avatar, it made $2.92 billion. Yeah. So could that ever cross 3?
Oh, 100%. Because that movie will see re-releases for decades.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Interesting.
And like before 3 comes out, they'll put 1 and 2 back in theaters.
They'll double up.
Yeah. Well, they're already doubling up for this one, right? Isn't AMC doing like
that's a good point.
The marathon.
Yeah. Does that count towards Avatar 1 box office?
Sure, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, think like before 7 comes out, they'll put 1 2 3 4 5 6
right
in theaters.
It's true. And then
pretty soon we'll live in a world where it'll just be theaters full of avatars.
That's right. And then when 7
everyone
comes
thought
out,
it was going to be theaters. Marvel. Everyone thought it was going to be Marvel superheroes, but it's just
much bluer than we thought.
7's going to be they're going to double bill that with Furious 7 when Avatar 7 comes out. Why not?
Actually, same exact plot line in those movies.
To be fair, they are both about family.
That's true.
The reason why Top Gun's coming back is because the only other alternate out there right now, aside from some of the art house films that are making their way for Oscar consideration, things like Empire of Light and The Whale and films that you can go see in the movie theaters around you, is Violent Night. So this is David Harbour playing Santa Claus in a movie that I've heard described multiple times as half Die Hard, half Home Alone. But with an R-rated sort of grisly take. I did not see it. The boys did. Jakey, what's your take on Violent Night?
I mean, this is one of those very unsexy reviews, but I thought it was just fine. It seemed very low hanging fruit in the like, hey, look, isn't this shocking? We're seeing Santa get drunk and throw up on people and beat the crap out of people. And it just sort of feels like, well, I mean, OK, I mean, I get it. I get what you're going for. But like, and there were, you know, David Harbour growling, you know, season's beatings. Sure. Got like a chuckle out of me. But I feel like, and again, completely different films, completely different concepts. But the, oh, my God, isn't it shocking watching Santa do this thing? That trope, you know, Billy Bob Thornton stole that 20 years ago when Bad Santa came out. So it's just it's just not, I don't think it has quite the, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm seeing this in front of my eyes appeal that I feel like the movie itself thinks it does. And I think Kevin will probably speak to the script, but the script is fairly poor, which I think really keeps it from, you know, crossing that level. It's fine. It's fine. But it's just like, it's not nearly as clever or shocking as I think it thinks it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Jeff? And it's all one of the things I will give it credit for. And this is one thing I like. So the 87 North is the company who produced this. The guys who did, you know, the team behind like Bullet Train and John Wick and, you know, Nobody. One thing I appreciated with Nobody, and I think it was really apparent in Nobody, and you've seen it in John Wick as well, is watching these action heroes actually get hurt. And, you know, in Nobody, for example, when we were on the bus with Bob Odenkirk and he's, you know, he's in that fight scene, we see him taking those hits. And then remember, he lands on that chair and just falls down in that fight scene and gets back up. So I think one of the cool things they did here was, and this is actually my favorite thing of the film, Santa, the powers that Santa has, he's able to utilize those within fight scenes. And I don't know if you agree with this, Jake, but I felt like they did a really good job balancing the idea that he didn't come out full force with those powers. He actually does get hurt. It does take adversity for him to get through fight scenes. And like 87 North is kind of known for their choreography and making fight scenes look as realistic as possible and have actual stunt actors doing these sequences. And I think that's why when you watch John Wick and you watch Nobody and you watch films of this company like Bullet Train, the fight scenes are amazing because they are actually done by teams of professional stunt actors who know how to choreograph long takes of action. And that stuff is cool.
Bullet Train. Never saw it.
That dude, you gotta see Bullet Train. Oh my God. Well, especially awesome. Like to your point where we live in a world where actors, you know, whether it be The Rock or Jason Statham, put in their contract how many times they're allowed to be punched and never really allowed to lose. I mean, we all of us grew up on actors who were more than happy to have their more than happy to have their asses kicked, like Harrison Ford, Schwarzenegger, Rocky. What makes like as big and otherworldly as those guys were, they weren't afraid to have their asses kicked on camera. And that's what gave them that human element that made those movies great. Whenever you read these articles about like, well, you know, for Hobbs and Shaw, you know, the Rock could be punched so many times and Jason Statham could be punched. And when it comes down to like a number and they're afraid to see this who gets more, like that bothers me. And so to your point, yes, we need to live in a world where like our heroes honestly get the crap beat out of them. You know, that should be the world we live in. It shouldn't be the exception. It should be the rule.
Yeah. And in this instant, like Santa, the powers this character has, you essentially could annihilate anybody that you're fighting. Right. And the payoff of the film is really cool because the powers build up and each scene, he kind of amps it up towards some clever ways that Santa could mess with somebody. That being said, and everything I just said, I fully believe in terms of what the movie does on an action level. It's just not well written. And here's the thing, and I actually hate when someone, or I don't like to use the word hate. My mom said never use the word hate. I dislike when you see a film that has great action, but you criticize the script and people go, wait, it was just an action movie. It's not supposed to have a good script. I disagree with that completely. And that's why I always praise James Cameron films like True Lies and Terminator 2 and Aliens, which are straight up action films that have really solid scripts and really solid characters. And in this case, Harbour's great. He's given good lines. The issue, and I guess I'll just explain what the plot in the beginning of the film is it's a family on Christmas. A group of villains come in, take the family hostage. Essentially, Santa's out delivering gifts that night. He happens to be at this particular place when this happens. And, you know, the whole point of the movie is for him to try and save the day. Jake, I don't know if you agree with me, but that family that is taken hostage, the writing and the characters are just not
I got so excited whenever I realized that sort of the matriarch of the family was Beverly D'Angelo. And I was like, that's fun. But she's honestly really bad.
And they have this kid who's like a social media star who's trying to like capture everything. And I get the modern times of it, but it just felt like every character was like, oh, we got to make this person that person. This person's that person. And it just felt really like they were plugging in what they thought a family dynamic would be in that situation. And like it just felt forced. And like, when you watch something like Nobody or even John Wick, I'm not saying those are class act scripts, but they work for the world that they're in.
Scripts.
Yeah, actually, but like, you know, it's funny. We keep mentioning sort of the elevator pitch of like, oh, it's a Die Hard with Santa, but cool it idea. Really does feel like someone in a conference room at in a studio in Hollywood literally said that, like, oh, we should make a movie that's Die Hard with Santa. Let's get on it. And then they came up with that elevator pitch before they came up with the movie.
Or worse, it almost feels like they just found the title. Like someone was like, hey, what about Violet Night? And then they were like, oh, damn.
I will say this. The movie, it's not horrible. It's just not. This is an exact example of the trailer being phenomenal. Mm. Like the trailer was awesome. And then the movie was just. Okay. I mean, but the action, I will say, if you like action and you like 87 North, like the company, you will get genuinely cool. There's a really cool Texas. You guys know what a Texas Switch is?
I do not.
Okay, well, Gabe
like
does.
The scene in if I'm not confusing it, it's like the scene in Hot Fuzz when he jumps over the fence, and then it looks like he's jumping over the fence like yards later, but it's just a different actor that they swap in, right? That's the
So like, I think one of the most famous, I think probably one of the greatest Texas Switches is in Place Beyond the Pines when we're on a oner behind Ryan Gosling and he drives his bike into that like circular thing, and in the middle of that shot, there's no edit, another driver takes over and you don't know it. And it's basically what you do with it is you follow a shot and then you go off to the left a little bit. The other actor steps out while off frame. The other stunt person steps in and finishes the shot. And then they'll redo it. Ryan will come back in, finish the shot. So like in Violent Night, there's the first major fight that Santa has with a villain as a really awesome Texas Switch. It's basically this like brutal brawl. And if you look closely, you'll see like it's a oner and it's Harbor theoretically the whole time. But if you watch closely, the camera will move. That's when the stunt guide steps in. David Harbor rolls out. He waits off camera, rolls back in. It's like kind of a cool. It's called a Texas Switch, I believe is the name for it. But it's
only
really
because I just watched T2 or the first 20 minutes of it today.
Yeah.
The moments when they cut to not Arnold on the motorcycle are hysterical.
So
is it someone wearing a mat? Oh, I don't know.
It looks like Jean-Claude Van Damme. It honestly looks like Jean-Claude Van Damme.
So I know we have to move on, but you brought that up. I had to mention it. So the 4K release of T2, I'm usually against this type of stuff. And people have been criticizing George Lucas for years for changing things in his films. But I think those were more story changes like with Han and Greedo.
Yes.
In this particular instance, back then when they shot that film and Arnold's coming off that ledge of that bridge with the motorcycle, back then we didn't really have face replacement. So it was an actual stunt actor who performed the sequence.
He fixed it for the 4K?
Yep. So the 4K, they actually went back in and put Arnold's face on the stunt guy and it looks phenomenal. Like they did a really good job. And I was like, you know what? That's one that I'm cool with them changing.
John, for the version that you were probably watching on Sci-Fi, they actually did face replacement as well, but it was Jean-Claude Van Damme.
right. It was you're watching T2 Hard Target. That's what
he goes off the ramp and before he lands, they cut to commercial. It was like 2.5 minutes of commercial.
And then an alien crawls across the screen. It's like tonight at 7.
Yeah. But no, James Cameron's
on set and he says, no, we don't need to finish the jump because this is when we're going to put the commercial break.
Exactly.
But nowadays, Sean, if that scene happened in a John Wick movie, Keanu Reeves wouldn't do that. They would have a stunt guy do it and then replace him with Keanu Reeves. But they just didn't have the tech back then. And now it looks really good.
Well, I'm saying I like the nostalgia of clear stuntman.
The old stunt guy. Yeah,
I like that.
Well, Cameron went back and changed the stars in Titanic. Like that's how meticulous. Like it was Neil deGrasse Tyson, which I think is the stupidest complaint in the world. Complained
like DiCaprio's not in it anymore.
No,
don't be that guy. It's a fun complaint.
But Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil deGrasse Tyson on Twitter, when it comes to film, I think is like the worst kind of film Twitter person. Where he's like this sort of he's the guy that's like, oh, well, like you do, then if Tom Cruise had ejected out of the plane at Mach 10, he would have turned it like, dude, nobody cares, man.
You're supposed
nobody
to have cares. Fun with that. You're supposed to have fun.
I don't
with
think
that.
He's doing it in a fun way.
I think he is.
Has he addressed the room on the door controversy?
An episode one that I get really angry about the whole door thing. Like there's a scene in the movie where he tries to get on the door and the door starts to tip. Like they address the fact that he can't get on it or it won't hold her. Like I don't understand this whole why it was such a contract. Like there is a scene where he tries to get on.
You don't try once. You try a few times.
No, he was cold,
Rose,
Sean.
Skirt, Rose, skitch to the edge.
I feel bad for here. Michelle. I feel bad for like Michelle on the Titanic and Sean going, could you just scooch over a little? There's room for me on this door.
I would 100% be yelling at her to scooch to the edge.
That's the least romantic.
Jake's like, I just don't think so, man.
I don't know.
Just
don't.
He's up on the door. He's like,
also,
sorry,
the stars
Sean,
aren't
just,
in the right place.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Jake's holding onto the door also. Don't argue,
there's
man.
No
there's
room.
Just no room.
There's no room.
Sean, are you sure? Are you sure? Jake's like, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And then in a lifeboat, Kevin's rowing by going, are you guys shooting on film?
Blowing a whistle.
They were shooting on film. 35.
All right, let's get to, speaking of being frozen in the water.
Gabe submerging in the water as he's rapping.
We are trying to get to this week's blend game, which is hashtag winter movie blend. So we like to mix it up every once in a while and get away from the actors and the directors and go with some type of a seasonal response. And my first one, I'm going to go first, and I'm going to say that my pick is Gremlins. Gremlins is a very fun holiday film that it's important that it's set during the wintertime. It's a Christmas gift, obviously, that Gizmo is to Billy. And from the get-go, when the dad is shopping and goes into that sort of down the hallway, down the alleyway shop where he finds the Mogwai, it's got that Christmas feel to it. He's Christmas shopping and trying to get something at the last minute. The conclusion in the town with the snowplow and Billy having to chase after the Gremlins has a great sort of winter feel to it as well, too. I think there's a lot of great stories that you could pick that are set during the winter time. But Gremlins is the one that really starts to get me in the mood for, hey, it's Christmas. Hey, it's cold outside. Gizmo's snuggled up inside of a little scarf as Corey Feldman is playing notes on the piano and getting him to sing. And I'm ready to see Spike throw plates at Billy's mom and hide in the Christmas tree and all the really fun elements that come with it. So I went with Gremlins. Kevin, where did you go for your hashtag winter movie blend?
Yeah. And what's crazy about this is like, my answer probably would change tomorrow. So this is where I'm at right now. But like when it comes to winter, like I you know, snow clearly plays a factor into the visual element of the film. And like Home Alone to me and Just Friends, I'm going to cheat and do two just because there are films that like get me into that winter cold spirit. Just Friends, obviously, with Ryan Reynolds, that was a movie that was special to me because of it was the first movie I ever professionally reviewed. And it was just, I don't know, for me, I put that on, they go, you know, it's cold, the movie's all about the Christmas time. It's cold, the snow, it plays a part. And there's a hilarious ice skating scene with Ryan Reynolds. So I don't know, that's a film that takes place in the wintertime that just reminds me of that time of year. Home Alone, the reason I bring that up is because, my buddy Dan, who I've been best friends with since I was 12, he's been doing this bit recently over the past couple of weeks where he'll just send me a screenshot of a movie he's watching and have me guess it. And luckily I've gotten every one of them right. Like he's like, how are you? So last night he sent me a photo of a clock in a house. That's all it was. And I was like, that's Home Alone. He goes, how the hell did you know that? And because back then, like, that's how I equated, like, those movies had feelings. Like, there was a feeling to the way the screen or the image would give me about the time of year.
Sure.
Yeah. And, like, Home Alone, even though it's a Christmas film, watching it at the end of November, even before Thanksgiving or after Thanksgiving, gets me into that winter vibe. And regardless of if you celebrate Christmas or not, that film just feels like purely winter, just like everything about the story. I mean, even down to a little scene where Macaulay Culkin's like sledding down his staircase to go out the door and then walking over to the convenience store to buy food and come back. It's just a feeling to it. I know The Shining might be like an obvious choice here, or The Gray and things like that, but I just, those are the films that I'm thinking about in my head at the moment of like films that give me that winter vibe. I know they're kind of random choices, but that's where I'm at.
Great choices.
Jakey?
I've talked extensively about my experience and my tradition of watching The Thing and The Shining in the winter, so I didn't want to use those because I've talked about that too much. Instead, I will talk about one of like my must-watch Christmas movies, which I feel like might surprise people because I don't talk about it a lot on the show. Every December, I genuinely look forward to watching Love Actually. I don't know why. Wow. It that Bill movie, Nighy, man. It just, it gets me. It really does. I get it's so cliche. It's almost like saying your favorite Christmas song is the Mariah Carey song. But I'm telling you, man, I get wrapped up in all the different stories. I get wrapped up when that little girl sings the Mariah Carey song at the end, when all of the stories start interconnecting with each other. And what's funny, you know, we often talk a lot about this show on the show about how as you get older, you know, how movies change for you. And it's interesting is that, you know, what my favorite story in that movie is changes as I've gotten older. You know, I used to really respond, you know, to this one, and now I respond to this one, and now, you know, I'm curious to see in 5 years, but I only allow myself.
The Neeson one gets me more now.
The Neeson one definitely, as I've gotten older, now, gets me a lot more. The Alan Rickman, you know, one really affects, you know, really kind of like breaks my heart more so. And, you know, the older I get, even though I love Alan Rickman, the less forgivable he is for me as I get older. And it's just, you know, and I always forget that Billy Bob Thornton plays the president. And it's always such a fun, pleasant surprise whenever he shows up and plays the most cliche, terrible American stereotype you could imagine. But I love it. The jokes still play for me. The dude who goes to the small town and Wisconsin? And meets he meets like the four most beautiful women in the world at the most dive bar you could possibly, like, it's just fantastic. And I only allow myself to watch it once a year to kind of make it a treat. I watch it in the month of December, usually, and with a week or so left to go for Christmas, so that it kind of times out with the timing of the film. And I look forward to it. I haven't watched it yet this year, and it's still November 30th. But I honestly, just talking about it, I'm like excited to, like, I make a thing of it. Like, it has to be a night where I have nothing else going on. I'll pour myself a little drink and I will watch Love Actually. And it gets me every time.
Dude, Bill Nighy's Christmas is All Around Us song, like, that is one of my favorite bits ever.
Yeah.
That movie, and Hugh Grant is so good in that movie. Like,
it kind of bother you that, like, and I remember asking Hugh Grant about it at a junket, actually the same weekend as the first Avatar junket, so it would have been 13 years ago. But I think he just did an interview recently where he talks about, like, not super, like, Hugh Grant doesn't love that movie, or, like, doesn't think his performance is good. Like, doesn't it kind of a bummer? It's like, dude, of all your movies, like, you don't love that one? Like, that's the one you're gonna talk badly about?
Paddington 2 star Hugh Grant?
Dude, you cannot. People love Paddington 2.
I love Paddington 2.
Dude, listen, I love it. And I love him in it. He's fantastic. I don't think I've ever seen Love Actually.
What?
I don't think I have. I think I've only seen clips of it.
You have to watch it,
man.
I think I've only seen, like, the sign changing, and I think I've only seen
Seen it 20 times.
But, like, the significance of that, clip, like all the clips that you've seen, like, the iconic moments.
Yeah.
The significance of them is what, like, I don't want to ruin it, but there's a reason that he's outside her door with signs. Like, it's
no, I totally understand, but I think legitimately. It's one of those ones where I've seen so many clips of it that I just feel
ask you and Michelle to please sit down this holiday season and press play on Love Actually?
But Jake, there's no way the card scene in the movie is more emotional than watching the two guys from Scrubs sell me Verizon or whatever.
I mean, I'm switching cellular services.
And I love those guys. I do. And that commercial hurts my heart.
You got to watch Love Actually with Michelle.
Dude,
Michelle seen it?
I don't know.
Arguably.
It's been around for a long time.
Top five romantic comedies of all time.
100%.
Interesting. All right. That's Kira in it. I'm down for
it. She's amazing in it. She's amazing. Yeah. Dude, Chiwetel Ejiofor is amazing. My favorite. The cast is insane.
Who else? Is it Laura Linney?
Martin Freeman, Laura Linney's in it too.
Yeah,
And also the like, what's funny is, like, you mentioned the plot line with the porn stand-ins. Like, the irony of, well, now I don't want to, like, say it out loud, but, like, the irony of what happens with that plot line is, like, it's fantastic.
All right. Audience picks. Indy Christina, she said The Day After Tomorrow. Good choice. That is a frigid movie. Christian Hestis went with something that I swore one of you two was going to go with, which was The Hateful Eight.
I do watch that every winter. That's another good one. I actually just watched the first half of it the other day.
People who are listening to us, watch the Netflix version of it, the episodic one.
I don't like the episodic one.
Oh, I love
it. To me, it doesn't flow as well.
Amanda Young said The Cutting Edge. Matt Caron said Fargo. Another great Fargo is a great choice.
That's what Rachel I thought of when we were talking about to the Daniels about going to look for the rocks. Yeah. There's a great story, because remember, like, Fargo tries to imply that it's a true story, but, like, you know, the names and events have changed for, you know. And I think that after Fargo came out, there were stories of people going to look for the money, because the money, in theory, would still be buried out there.
That's funny.
So that's what I thought of whenever they were talking about don't go look for the rocks. I thought of, like, the money from Fargo.
Rachel Ho says Out of Sight, which I didn't realize was a winter movie, but I haven't seen Out of Sight in a really long time.
She did note for some random reason. It seems like it's just for her randomly. It feels like a winter movie.
Huh.
Yeah. Good for you.
There are no real rules to this game.
That's what I said.
Why not? And then Philip Addison says The Nice Guys, noting technically any Shane Black movie is a Christmas movie. And I think that's very fair.
Okay, Iron Man 3 is a Christmas movie.
It is.
I remember when what was it? Like, when we did the junket, because it came out the first weekend of May, so we would have done the junket in April. And, like, it was just felt so weird, like, watching that movie in April. I was like, this doesn't feel like it should have come out right now.
Very true. Good point. For next week, reach out on Twitter using hashtag Ewan McGregor blend.
Oh,
so get us your...
I know mine.
Get us your favorite films starring T2. Ewan McGregor, and you can let us know... What? He's not in T2. And
he
let
is
us
in
know
T2.
Ewan McGregor is in T2?
Well, the other T2.
Oh, okay.
It actually was called... No, it actually was called T2.
Yeah. Yes, it was called T2. That's right. Or you can email us at realblend@cinemablend.com if you would like us
to
hear
your... Blown.
Your Ewan McGregor pick for next week's blend game. In the meantime, our next premium episode, which is going to be dropping on Monday, is going to be the two film challenge. Actors Volume 2. Again, check out the description wherever you are listening to us to figure out how to get access to the premium episodes. Want to throw out a plug to the real ones. Gabe, what do we have to say about the real ones?
Well, no, for the real ones. The real ones, again, are they're all the real ones, but the ones that, you know, stick through the outro, through the rigmarole. Because next week's guest, and partially why we're playing Ewan McGregor blend, is Guillermo del Toro.
Yes, yes. Hashtag it happened already.
Guillermo del Toro, folks.
This one's fun, man.
As long as I don't accidentally delete the footage, he's going to be on the show.
Oh, my God. He is so much fun. He tells some stories that
it's so good.
Shocked us of how much fun they are. Yes, he's going to be a terrific listen. So, hey, real ones, you made it this far, and you guys now know that Del Toro will be our guest on next week's episode. In the meantime, follow us online at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We will talk to you guys sometime soon in the near future, and follow
but
our
first,
socials.
We're off to London.
Specifically, yeah, because we're going to be in London covering a number of crazy things, including Avatar and possibly 1923 and something else. Oh, we can't say that out loud yet, though, can we?
We won't mention any
of
that.
What I just said.
But what I'll say, and I won't make you guys commit to anything because I think your schedules are still up in the air. Are the three of you going to try to do an impromptu, you know, throw out a quick tweet? Maybe, hey, we're at this bar.
Come it's tough home. because Sunday are all of our schedules. There are so many elements where we're just waiting on timing. Yeah.
I ask you on air because I know a lot of the London...
It would have to be Sunday.
I'd love to do it.
Yeah, it would have to be Sunday.
It would have to be Sunday, and we just don't know our Sunday times.
And there are some interviews that, in theory, that we would be doing via Zoom, where the talent would be. Yeah, so I mean, in theory, like I mean, if we could potentially get done at like 9 o'clock, I'd be down to take off.
Here's what I'll say to the folks in the UK: don't make a trip to London this weekend, hoping that it's going to happen. Yeah. But if you're in London,
but if you're in London,
pay attention to Twitter. And
the
guys will tweet out if they
we
get
will
the
be
chance.
Around.
Yeah, there might be an announcement that we are going to celebrate a very busy day by heading to a pub to watch Kentucky. Fucking Kentucky is going to be in London. That's insane.
And first round
on the TVs.
On Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Yeah,
that's what I've heard.
Yeah.
So anyway, in the meantime, Larry Crown.
Larry Crown.
Hashtag elephant feces.
Oh, no.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.